It is sometimes said that ministers all have one sermon each. And this, when I look back over my 12 years serving a congregation, this may have been the sermon that I was working my way towards. In telling the story of his awakening, Confucius said, and I paraphrase here, "At 15, I set my heart on learning. At 30, I planted my feet firmly in day-to-day living. At 40, I no longer suffered from uncertainty. At 50, I knew what made my heart sing. At 60, I knew equanimity. At 70, I became an authentic person of no fixed position." Confucius lived masterfully. In sitting down to tell the story of my life, I discovered that there were 6 spiritual disciplines of human flourishing that had guided me to my own awakening. Like Confucius, I could say, at 15, I set my heart on learning. At 30, I planted my feet firmly in day-to-day living. At 40, I far less often suffered from uncertainty. At 50, I knew what made my heart sing. At 60, I finally discovered equanimity. So now I seek to grow in wisdom and understanding into my 70s and beyond. For me, the first and foundational spiritual discipline was resiliency. So let me tell you a story about how I developed resiliency at the age of 6, which will give you some sense of my path. Ranger Elementary School was a small, aging brick building that served kids from the poorer side of Tiverton. It faced Stafford Road, the main street on that side of town, with a parking lot on one side and a large grassy playground on the other side, and also behind the school. Written in stone over the main entrance door, the school motto said, "We do things because they are right, not because we're being watched." We saw this every morning as we came into school. And that was the spirit of the place, with a proud claim to righteousness and relatively little monitoring of each child's behavior. The teachers were not particularly well educated, and most had similarly low expectations for their students. However, it played a major role in our socialization process. Behaving appropriately was generally held in higher esteem than displays of intelligence. Being respectable was far more important than being good. Beginning in first grade, I discovered the boys played marbles at recess. I didn't know how to play marbles. Marbles cost money. We were poor. No one was allowed to play marbles unless you played for keepsies, where the loser must give his marbles to the winner. This felt like a form of gambling that I thought my Baptist minister father might not approve of. And even if you won, you could still lose your marbles. If they spilled onto the floor, the teacher would confiscate them and give them to the janitor. Accumulating marbles was a risk. But having no marbles felt like a disaster. Many boys bought bags of 50 shiny marbles for $1 per bag at the local variety store. For those who didn't have that kind of money or couldn't get it from their allowance or borrow it from their parents, it was possible to buy 3 shiny new marbles for a dime. As a last resort for the truly destitute 6-year-old, the janitor was willing to resell any used marbles gathered from the classroom floor for a penny apiece. So everybody could afford to play except me. I was still in debt due to a broken egg timer, but that's another story. So no marbles for me. I had no money, not even a penny, and knew better than to ask my mom or dad for gambling money. I couldn't afford to play marbles, yet I had to play. I knew I could be good at it. If only I could find a way to escape my poverty long enough to accumulate some marbles. I didn't want my poverty to define me. At Ranger Elementary, everyone looked down at the Sherbloom kids as poor. Our house was always dirty, overcrowded, and in a state of disrepair. I mentioned I already had my 9 siblings. I'm the 5th of 10. With 6-inch nails protruding from unfinished interior walls. As the 5th child in this large family, my clothes were mostly hand-me-downs. Many of these were cheap clothes when they were new, and all of them showed signs of wear and tear. But marbles felt like my destiny. My older brothers were too focused on other things to play marbles. This would be my proving ground. This would be my domain. I became absurdly focused upon this quest. One day coming out to recess, I found a marble lying at the edge of the grass. Someone had forgotten it or dropped it running for the bell. Now I had my chance. I chose to play one of the smaller boys, Paul. Paul shot his marble and won. Again, I felt doomed, no money and no marbles. But Paul, in his big-hearted way, lent me a marble to keep playing, and this time I won. By the end of recess, I had played dozens of games of marbles, and miraculously had won more than I lost. So I went triumphantly back to class with two warm marbles nestled in my pocket. Every recess thereafter I played, and every recess I got better. I brought an intensity and focus few could bring to playing marbles. By spring, I was the best marble player on the playground. This is my earliest remembered experience of being in that zone where concentrating completely and everything just falls into place and feels absolutely right. I loved it. This sense of mastering the universe, however, is highly addictive. Once you've been there, you want to get back to that feeling of mastery. My marble collection grew to several hundred marbles. I began to sell them back to the other boys at two marbles for a penny, undercutting the janitor by half and virtually eliminating any competition from the variety store. Because my prices were the best in town, everybody bought marbles from me. Most days after school, my pockets bulged with marbles and increasingly with money. Now I had spending money, so I could begin to buy my own used books at a nickel or a dime each. I no longer thought of myself as poor because now I had resources. By the end of third grade, it was no longer cool to play marbles at recess. But by then, I'd spent some of my newfound wealth buying social status, tithed 10% to the church, opened a bank account with $18 from marble sales, plus gave over 3,000 marbles to my younger brothers. My sense of the possibilities skyrocketed. I was an entrepreneur. I had a facility for money-making, for understanding how money works, and making my way in the world. In short, I had a facility for success. Much I would later accomplish in life took root in those playground's victories. I would never underestimate the power of focused intent and awareness ever again. I just have to remember what it feels like to play marbles and win. There's no way to adequately express how this experience of being in the zone changed me, both for better and for worse. I experienced the joy of being the best at something. I didn't need to settle for being poor. I learned the value of taking risks, persistence in the face of failure, and intense focus above all else. I developed a spiritual resilience. Anything is possible. I even developed a sociable and pleasant personality to get people to support and encourage my success as their success. I developed a taste for the sweet fruits of success and wealth as I went forth to take on the world. Focus, persistence, risk-taking, and resilience have been key elements in my story throughout my life. But the very first element I learned was audacious resilience. All my subsequent spiritual disciplines were built upon this foundation of resilience, the kind of resilience that comes only from being put to the test and rising to great challenges. In later years, when people would ask where and how I developed my unsinkable confidence, audacious resilience, and sense that anything was possible and many risks really are worth taking, I'd say I learned it all playing marbles. Then at Tiverton High School, I had the great good fortune of coming under the tutelage of a remarkable man, Bradford Robinson, a Harvard-educated WASP who prepared me for the Ivy League, the first in my school ever to have the audaciousness to even apply to the Ivy League, resulting in my being finally accepted to Yale, where a series of crises and mistakes, mostly mine, nearly led to my total undoing as a human being. And it was from that experience that I learned the second spiritual discipline of ego surrender. Only by surrendering everything, including my sense of self, was I emptied out enough to discover my source of human flourishing. Just before my junior year at Yale ended, I met a remarkable woman who attracted me immediately. Loretta sparked something in me, making me want to be my best self for her, and I didn't even know her yet. Over the next year, I courted her and eventually won her heart. So you will discover if you look at my book Spiritual Audacity is dedicated with a deep, unconditional love to Loretta, who saved me, and of course, for she has been my true love and life companion these last 40 years, and of course, for our audacious children, who may ask me not to mention them by name. The third spiritual discipline, gratitude for everything, is captured best by Coleman Bach's rendition of that Rumi poem called The Guest House. It's short, I'll offer it again here. This being human is a guest house. You may have thought you were a recluse or you were in your own home. You are in a guest house. You only have some say over what happens. The rest comes to you. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. They never call ahead. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. It makes it more possible to respond with resilience to that which comes upon us if we can view each day as a guest house where we don't control what comes, only how we respond to it. The fourth spiritual discipline is generosity. Generosity with our time and with our money, and most of all, generosity of spirit. Not giving away everything we have. We don't have to be afraid of losing it. But also not grasping for all that we want either. Using tithing is a way to bring our ego selves into alignment with the mystery of life. This is a lifelong spiritual practice well worth cultivating. The Unitarian Universalist Church financial consultant Mark Hewitt, in his book, The Generosity Path, says, "Generous means freely giving more than is necessary or expected. So generosity includes the idea of open-handedness, along with a connection to our internal experience and spirituality. Generosity ennobles us. It makes us great souls." The fifth spiritual discipline is learning to dwell in divine mystery. Now, part of what made my journey so difficult is that many 20th century and still many 21st century religious Americans make an idolatry of God. They create a concretized notion and they then worship that. The problem is the nature of God is a deep mystery. Not like a true crime story mystery where someone is guilty and your job is to figure out who it is, but rather in the sense of being ultimately unknowable. As the Tao Te Ching expresses it, that which can be named and fully known is not real, and that which is real cannot be named and fully known. Or as the Rabbi Lawrence Kushner expresses it, the first mystery is simply that there is a mystery that can never be explained or understood, only encountered from time to time. Nothing is obvious, everything conceals something else. The Hebrew word for universe, olam, comes from the word for hidden. Something of the Holy One is hidden within, and it is the search for that mystery that brings us to awakening. So finally, the sixth spiritual discipline is awakening to ultimate reality. For me, this resulted in a series of pilgrimages with various mystics, including traveling up the Ganges River in the footsteps of the Buddha to find enlightenment. This audacious approach to the spiritual journey is captured in that old Zen tale, ox herding, that I read from my book. The Buddhist term most closely associated with what I have been describing as spiritual audacity or human flourishing is the Pali word, virya. This word is most often translated into English as energy, effort, boldness, strength, courage, perseverance, or persistence. But none of those English words, at least in their contemporary American usage, quite capture the essence of what I intend with spiritual audacity. What I intend is boldly living in the zone of transcendental experience, living the life we were born to live. Our working life, our home life, and spiritual life are not three and distinct things, but three aspects of our well-being. Spiritual audacity, practicing the six disciplines of resilience, surrender, gratitude, generosity, mystery, and awakening, allows these three aspects of well-being to interpenetrate and become interdependent. This leads to far greater joy through human flourishing. As humanity's increasingly global civilization emerges in the 21st century, imagine the incredible power of the awakening that awaits humanity if we will only do the work to get there. I was born at the right time, and so were you, to participate in just such a spiritual awakening of humankind. Unitarian Universalism is an awesome faith for 21st century human flourishing and gives us a basis under which we can engage in helping to make the world become that which it is capable of being. I love you all dearly. Amen and blessed be.